The origins of Unix are part of computing lore, and the basic story has been told many times. The Unix Oral History Project is designed to capture it in the words and voices of the people who created the system and who oversaw its development and dissemination within Bell Laboratories. While the participants speak of technical matters, they also reflect on the environment that both fostered Unix and in turn was shaped by it as it evolved from an operating system to a way of thinking about computing. I'm Michael S. Mahoney, an historian of science at Princeton University, and what follows are excerpts from my conversations with some of the main figures in the early history of Unix. It began in the late spring of 1969 as a file system. Ken Thompson, who designed it with Dennis Ritchie and Rudd Kanaday, had been using the lab's GE635 to explore ideas about a disk-based file system which would allow several users to work simultaneously without interfering with one another. Thompson tells how this line of inquiry led to an actual system.
It was never down to a design to the point of, you know, where you put the addresses and how you expand files and, you know, things like that. It was never down to that level. It was always a scenario. I think it was just like one or two meetings. Dennis and Kanaday and myself was just discussing these ideas of the general nature of keeping the files out of each other's hair and the nitty-gritty of expanding of the real implementation, where you put the block addresses, where you put this. And I remember we did it in Kanaday's office. At the end of this discussion, Kanaday picked up the phone, and there was a new service in Bell Laboratories, that station. And you call up essentially a tape recorder,
mm-hmm.
and you give notes.
Mm-hmm.
And then next morning, the notes are typed and sent to you.
Uh-huh.
And the next day, these notes came back. And all the acronyms were butchered. I know the ZYE. So we got back these this description, and they were copied, and we each got copies of them. Became the working document, the file system, which was just built a day or two on the PDP-7.
Mm-hmm. The PDP-7. The famous graphics machine that you found.
Mm-hmm.
When you found that, you had it in mind to just put the file system on there, or
at first, yes. We used it for other things, that was famous space travel game.
Uh-huh.
But it was a natural candidate of a place to put the file system. When we hacked out this rough design of the file system on the dictation, mm-hmm. that day in Kanaday's office, I went off and implemented it on the PDP-7. The system didn't exist by itself very long. What we did was, to run the file system, you had to create files and delete files and read and write files to see how well it performed. To do that, we needed a script of what kind of traffic you wanted on the file system. And the script we had was, you know, paper tapes that, you know, read a file, delete a file, you know, write a file, this kind of stuff. And you'd run the script through the paper tape, and it would rattle the disk a little bit. You wouldn't know what happened. You know, you just couldn't look at it. You couldn't see it. You couldn't do anything.
Mm-hmm.
We built a couple of tools on the file system to... We used this paper tape thing to load the file system with these tools. And then we would run the tools out of the file system. That's called exec, by the way. And type at these tools. That was called the shell, by the way. To drive the file system into the contortions that we wanted to measure how it worked and react. So it only lasted by itself for maybe a day or two before we started developing the things that we needed to load it.
At what point did you feel you had something here?
Well, the first one was not at all multi-programmed. And it was almost like subroutine on a file system. The read call, the system read call was in fact call read of the file system. And it was very synchronous, just subroutine call in the file systems for these applications. And there was a very quick rewrite that admitted that it was an operating system and I had a kernel user interface that you track across. I really can't remember what the realization was. I mean, the total time span from initially starting with walking downstairs, down there, with the idea that we're going to build a file system.
When was this?
Yeah, it was the summer of 69.
Summer of 69.
In fact, my wife went on vacation to my family's place in California to visit my parents. We just had a new son on August 68. And they hadn't seen the kid, and so Bonnie took the kid to visit my family. And she was gone a month to California, and I allocated a week each to the shell, to the operating system, the shell, the editor, and the assembler, to get it to reproduce itself. During the month she was gone, which was in the summer of 69, it was totally rewritten in a form that looked like an operating system. Tools that were sort of known, assembler and editor shell. If not maintaining itself, right on the verge of maintaining itself, to sever the GCOS connection.
Oh, so that you could work directly on it.
Yeah. And from then on, it kept coming up.
So we're talking about months. A month's development.
Essentially, one person per month.
The first versions of Unix were written in assembler, but it had been Thompson's intention from the start that, like Multics, it would eventually be written in a high-level language. Dennis Ritchie, who collaborated on the file system, contributing the concept of treating I.O. devices as files, designed that language. Here he talks about its evolution.
Who designed C?
Yeah, although not from scratch.
It was an adaptation of B,
which was, that was pretty much Ken's. B actually started out as support. Ken one day said the PDP-7 Unix system needed a Fortran compiler in order to be a serious system. And so he actually sat down and started doing the Fortran grammar. This was before Mac. He actually started in TMG, which was... It took me about a day to realize that he didn't even do a Fortran compiler at all. He did this very simple language called B. Got it going in the PDP-7. B was actually moved to the 11. A few system programs were written, not the operating system itself, the utilities. It's fairly slow because it was an interpreter. And there were sort of two realizations about the problems with the... one was that because of the implementation was interpreted, it was always going to be slow. And the second was that, unlike all the machines we'd used before, which were word-oriented, we now had a machine that was unoriented. And that the basic notions, some of the basic notions that were built into B, which was in turn based on BCPL, were just not really right for this byte-oriented machine. In particular, B and BCPL had notions of pointers, which were names of storage cells. And a byte-oriented machine in particular, and also one in which the it had 16-bit words, and I don't think it did originally, but they were clearly intending to have 32-bit and 64-bit floating point numbers. So there were all these different sizes of objects. And BCP and BCPL are really oriented towards a single size development.
Mm-hmm.
Now, from a linguistic point of view, that was the biggest limitation.
Mm-hmm.
It sort of, not only the fact that all objects were the same size, but also that just the whole notion of pointer to object was, didn't fit well with the E. And so, more or less simultaneously, I started trying to add types to the language, to the E, and fairly soon afterwards tried to write a compiler for the language changes came first. For a while it was called NB, or New B. It was also an interpreter. And it actually started with the B compiler. Because C was written in a language very much like itself at every stage in the game. So yeah, it must have started with the B compiler and sort of merged it into a C compiler and added the type structure. And then tried to convert that into a new compiler. The basic construction of the compiler, of the code generator for the compiler, was based on an idea that I'd heard about someone at the labs at Indian Hill. And I never actually did find and read the thesis, but I had the ideas in it explained to me. And so the code generator for NB became based on this PhD thesis. It was also the technique used in the language called, which was called EPL, which was used for switching systems in ESS machines.
Okay.
So it stood for ESS programming language.
Mm-hmm.
So the first phase of C was really these two phases in short succession of first some language changes from B, really adding the type structure without too much change in the syntax and doing the compiler. Second phase was slower. It all took place within a very few years, but it was a bit slower, so it seemed. And it stemmed from an attempt to, the first attempt to rewrite the Unix. So Ken started trying it in the summer, probably 1972, and gave up. And it may be because he got tired of it or whatnot, but there were sort of two things that went wrong. And one was his problem, in that he couldn't figure out how to run the basic sort of coroutine in multi-programming primitives, how to switch control from one process to another, the relationship inside the kernel of different processes. The second thing that he couldn't easily handle was, from my point of view, the more important, and that was the difficulty of getting proper data structure. The original version of C did not have structures.
I see.
So to make tables of objects, process tables and file tables and this tables and that tables, it was really fairly painful. And one of the techniques that we borrowed from seeing using BCPL was to define names were actually small constants, and then use these essentially as subscripts. You use pointers, basically you would use a pointer offset by a small constant that was named to name, do the equivalent of naming a field of a structure. It was clumsy. I guess people still do the same sort of thing in Fortran. The combination of the things caused Ken to give up that summer. Over the year, I added structures and probably made the compiler somewhat better, better code. And so over the next summer, we made, that was when we made a concerted effort and actually did redo the whole operating system in C.
By the end of the summer of 73, Unix was an operating system written in its own high-level language, C, but had not yet become a philosophy of computing. That came with the program called Pipe, and the idea of software tools that it solidified. Doug McElroy talks about the tortuous path to pipes.
I do want to talk about pipes, because Richie says in his retrospect, not only that was it your suggestion, but indeed he suggests that it's your insistence.
That is one of the only places where I very nearly exerted managerial control over Unix. Was pushing for those things. Yes.
Why pipes?
Why pipes?
Yeah. Where did the idea come from?
Goes way back. There was in the early '60s, Conway wrote an article about coroutines. '63, perhaps, in the CACN. I had been doing macros from starting back in 59 or 60. And it, if you think about macros, they mainly involve switching data streams. I mean, you're taking in you're taking input, you suddenly come to a macro call.
Mm-hmm.
And that says, stop taking input from here, go take it from a definition.
Gotcha.
And in the middle of a definition, you'll find another macro call. So macros, even as early as 64, somewhere I talked of a macro processor as a switchyard for data streams. Also in 64, there's a paper that's hanging on Brian's wall still, he dredged out somewhere, where I talked about screwing together streams like garden hoses. So this idea had been hanging around in my head for a long time. At the same time that Thompson and Ritchie were on their blackboard sketching out an OS system, I was sketching out how to do data processing on this blackboard by connecting together cascades of processes and looking for a kind of prefix notation language for connecting processes together, and failing because it's very easy to say cat into grep into, or who into cat into grep and so on. It's very easy to say that, and it was clear from the start that that was something you'd like to say. But there are all these side parameters that these commands have. They don't just have input and output arguments, but they have the options.
Mm-hmm.
And syntactically, it was not clear how to stick the options into this chain of things written in prefix notation. Cat of grep of who. Syntactic blinders. Didn't see how to do it. So I had these very pretty programs written on the blackboard in a language that wasn't strong enough to cope with reality, so we didn't actually do it. And I over a period from 1970 till 72, I'd from time to time say, yeah, how about making something like this? And I'd put up another proposal. And one day I came up with a syntax for the shell that went along with the piping. And Ken said, I'm going to do it. He was tired of hearing all this stuff. And that was certainly what the next, that you've read about it several times, I'm sure. That was absolutely a fabulous day the next day. He said, I'm going to do it. He didn't do exactly what I had proposed for the pipe system call. He invented a slightly better one that finally got changed once more to what we have today. He did use my clumsy syntax. He put pipes into Unix, you put this notation into shell all in one night. And the next morning, we had this people gave it a hit. Oh, and he also changed a lot of most of the Unix programs up to that time couldn't take standard input because there wasn't the real need. Mm-hmm. They all had file arguments. Grep had a file argument. The cat had a file argument. Anyway, and Thompson saw that wasn't going to fit with the scheme of things. And he went in and he changed all those programs in the same night. I don't know how. And the next morning we had this orgy of one-liners.
And they were the lovely features. Pipes is the way it reinforces the notion of the toolbox.
Not only reinforced, almost created.
Well, that was my question. Was the notion of the toolbox there before?
No.
Pipes, or did Pipes create it?
Pipes created it.
Unix looked different after Pipes. I mean, in subtle ways.
There, yes. The philosophy that everybody started putting forth. This is the Unix philosophy. Write programs that do one thing and do it well. Write programs to work together. Write programs that handle text streams, because that is a universal interface. All of those ideas which add up to the tool approach. Might have been there in some unformed way prior to Pipes, but they really came in afterwards.
The idea of tools took written form in Brian W. Kernahan's and P.J. Plauger's software tools. But, as Kernahan recalls, it was Pipes that first made the idea gel.
I think that beyond that, the notion of tools or languages or anything like that did not show up in my consciousness until noticeably further on, probably when Unix was actually running on the PEP-11, which would get to be 172, that kind of time. And even there, not really.
Before or after Doug did Pipes? Is Pipes triggered with this notion?
I think it probably was the capstone or whatever. I'm not sure what the right image is, but it's the thing that makes it all work in some sense. It's not that you couldn't do those kinds of things, because I already redirection predates Pipes by a noticeable amount. Mm-hmm. Not a tremendous amount, but it definitely predates it. I mean, that's an oldish idea. And that's enough to do most of the things that you currently do with Pipes. It's just not notationally anywhere near so convenient. I mean, it's sort of loosely analogous to working with Roman numerals instead of Arabic numerals. I mean, it's not you can't do arithmetic, it's just a bitch. Much more difficult, perhaps, and therefore mentally not more constraining. But all that stuff is sort of now squashed into such a narrow interval that I don't even know when it happened. I remember the preposterous syntax, the greater than or whatever syntax that somebody came up with, and then all of a sudden there was the vertical bar and just everything clicked at that point. And that was the time then I could start to make up these really neat examples that would show things like doing, running who and collecting the output in a file and then word counting the file to say how many users there were and then saying, look how much easier it is with the word count, or with the who into the word count, and then running who into grep and starting to show combinations that were things that were never thought of, and yet they were so easy you could just compose them at the keyboard and get them right every time. And that's, I think, when we started to think probably consciously about tools, because then you could compose the things together if you had made them so that they actually worked together. And that's when people went back and consciously put into programs the idea that they read from a list of files, but if there were no files, they read from the standard input so that they could be used in pipelines.
The tools approach, the Unix philosophy, soon began to reflect generally shared patterns of thought. Joe Condon, whose group originally owned the PDP-7 on which the first Unix system was implemented, later moved to computing research and started to use the system itself. He recalls how Robert Morris introduced him to the Unix way of thinking.
Bob Morris, who was in the group, you know, I would come in and say, how do you understand what these commands do? Because the manuals aren't, and the manual pages aren't all that clear. And he says, well, what do you think it is a reasonable thing to do? Try some experiments with it and find out, Jack. And that was a very interesting clue. At least his philosophy and some of the other people's philosophy, I think Dennis's also, of how how a thing should work is that it should work in a way which is easy to understand. That it shouldn't be a complex function, which is all hidden in a bunch of rules and verbiage and whatnot. That the field of cognitive engineering. And I think Bob Morris is telling me. I know that's somehow the way he felt, and I think that's the way Dennis feels too, is that the black box itself should be simple enough such that when you form the model of what's going on in the black box, that's in fact what is going on in the black box. Wouldn't write a program to try out what person to try and double guess what they're going to want to do. You should make it such that you're what it does.
Brian Kernahan speaks of how that way of thinking shaped the design of tools. EQN is a package for typesetting mathematics.
What was your first major project on Unix? When did it start to become a part of your research program?
The first substantial thing that I can remember was EQN, which Lorinda and I did. And that, I would guess, was 73 or early 74. The initial development was very, very short. But you could probably date it almost exactly. It was written in C, so there had to be a working C compiler, which would presumably put it in 72 or 73. There had to be a working Yak because you used the Yak grammar. It was done, in fact I could find out from this, it was done, there was a graduate student who had worked on a system for doing mathematics, but had a very different notion of what it should be. It basically looked like function calls. And so, although it might have worked, he A, didn't finish it, I think, and B, the model probably wasn't right. I remember he and Lorinda had worked on it, or she had been guiding him or something like that, and I looked at it and I thought, gee, that seems wrong. There's got to be a better way to say it. I mean, and then suddenly I drifted into this notion of do it the way you say it. And I don't know where that came from, although I can speculate. I had spent sort of like the time, maybe a couple of years, when I was a graduate student at Recording for the Blind at Princeton.
Really?
You know, I read stuff like Computing Reviews and scattered textbooks of one sort and another, so I was used to at least speaking mathematics out loud. Conceivably that triggered some kind of neurons, I don't know.
The common philosophy integrated the separate efforts of many people, each creating tools to meet his or her own needs, and then making the tools available to the group. As Unix grew, the manual became a way of maintaining its integrity and coherence. Dennis Ritchie set the style, initially, and then Doug McElroy took charge of the effort. A.G. Sandy Fraser comments on its importance.
He had a lot to do specifically with the manual. Now, you may think of that as a clerical job, but don't think of it that way. The manual was, the fact that there was a manual, that he insisted on a high standard in the manual, meant that he insisted on a high standard in every one of the programs that was documented.
Mm-hmm.
When they say, as they have just done, to produce the next edition of the manual, the work that went into producing the manual involved rewriting all sorts of programs in order that they should meet the same high standard. And then add to all of that, it's probably the first manual that ever had a section with bugs in it. That's a level of honesty you don't find. You know, it wasn't that they simply documented the bugs, you were too lazy to fix them. They fixed a lot of bugs.
Mm-hmm.
But some of them weren't so easy to fix. Or they were uncertain because they didn't want to do it. And so they documented that. I think a level of intellectual honesty that's present in that activity is rare.
McElroy himself speaks of the manual in aesthetic terms, noting that it, like Unix itself, was a luxury perhaps only a research environment could afford.
The cleaning something up so you can talk about it is really quite typical of Unix. Every time a manual, another edition of the manual would be made, there'd be a flurry of activity. And when you wrote down the uglies, you would say, we can't put this in here. Take features out or put features in order to make them easier to talk about. It's the virtue of being in a research center. You don't have to keep any old software running.